Thanks very much, guys. It's a real pleasure for me to be here. What am I hoping to achieve tonight? Firstly, I'm hoping to raise questions for all of us. I'm obviously a Catholic priest, and I'm basing my talk tonight on the thought of Thomas Aquinas, who was also a Catholic priest. But the questions I'm addressing are simply part of the human condition. What's life all about? Who am I? What kind of world do we live in? How can we decide what's right and what's wrong? How should we live? So those questions are not unique to Catholics at all. They're accessible to every single one of us. And I'm sure they've occurred to all of us at various different times. When Aquinas himself addressed these questions, he makes use of the thought of thinkers who were pagans, like Aristotle, or Muslims, like Avicenna, or Jews, like Maimonides. And I think it's good to ponder these big questions together from time to time. And I'm really interested afterwards in hearing your answers to these various questions. Secondly, I'm not planning a massive and detailed defense of Thomas's arguments for the existence of God, the famous five ways. You can find buckets of videos and articles and books all over the place in any library. You'd find tons of stuff on that topic. And I have very little to add to that conversation. This isn't my area of expertise, and I'm not a professional philosopher. But this talk, the topic of the talk, has been very, very important to my own personal story, and I'm going to mention that as well a little bit. What I am going to do is I'm going to outline the third of the five ways, and I've given you the texts of the second way as well, and the third way. They're texts one and two, and I'm happy to talk them through afterwards, but I won't be getting into the nitty-gritty of the talk. If you want the nitty-gritty, I've given you a book there on the bibliography by Edward Fazer, and I'd recommend that. I'd also recommend you read Dennis Turner. Dennis Turner was once sitting where you are sitting, 50 years ago or so. He was a student in UCD. He was a member of Logos, a Catholic student society, and he went on to become a professor of theology in Cambridge and then professor of theology in Yale. And his inaugural theology lecture in Cambridge was called How to Be an Atheist, which is where I stole this title. So I'm not going into the nitty-gritty so much. I'm aiming for the big picture. Thomas's arguments, they're not standalone items of thought. They have various assumptions built into them, and they have consequences that flow from them. They only take up about one page of the Summa Theologiae, which is Thomas's masterpiece, and Thomas wrote an awful lot more. So this isn't the core of his thought necessarily, but it is important. I'll be attempting to fill in the details of the big picture for you tonight, because the assumptions and the consequences of the arguments, they form a world view. So for me, you won't necessarily be getting hard-nosed, rigorous Thomism of the strict observance. It's more like Aquinas after a few drinks. I should have said Aquinas and the lads after a few drinks, because we're going to talk about a few atheist thinkers as well. My plan is to analyse their worldviews in light of the theistic worldview of Thomas Aquinas. And in fact, when you have St. Thomas's worldview in mind, certain very challenging objections are instantly raised to various forms of atheism. And Aquinas, I think, makes it more difficult, for atheists to be atheists. So in this sense, my talk will be pretty provocative, but I hope respectful as well, because some of my favourite Christian writers, for example, are former atheists, C.S. Lewis, Simone Weil, Edith Stein, Alistair McGrath, and I think their experience of atheism is central to their later writing. When I was at college, many of my best friends were atheists, and my conversations with them were really, really important to me. They purified my concepts, they challenged my language, and they introduced me to all kinds of awkward objections. Those conversations were really precious to me, and they were nothing like the kind of snide and sneering debates between atheists and theists that I used to come across in debating societies and online. Those kind of debates, they're all about, you know, drop the mic moments and all that. And that's not something I have any interest in being a part of. And I'm genuinely interested in hearing from the atheists here after my talk. And it may be that your versions of atheism escape all the traps I'm going to lay for them here. And if so, I want to hear more. So, the third way. Like all the five ways, the third way starts with an observation, not about God, but about the world. Thomas discovers things in nature that have a certain feature which he finds noteworthy. And this feature is that they are possible to be and not be. Or they have the potential to be or not to be. Hamlet knew all about this. Hamlet knew that he was not the kind of being that naturally exists forever. Our capacity to exist or not exist, the capacity of any object in the world to exist or not exist, let's just call it contingency. And whatever is not contingent, we'll call necessary. Now, when we come across something that has the capacity to exist or not to exist, that is everything we've ever come across in our entire lives, it always makes sense to ask, why does this exist? It doesn't make sense to ask, why do triangles have three sides? Because the statement, triangles have three sides, is necessarily true. It's true by definition. But say I come across a rat. This little guy is actually an art student right here in UCD. I might know the definition of a rat, but the definition doesn't include the rat's existence. So I can still ask, why does this rat exist? This existing rat, along with every other existing contingent thing, is a walking question mark. I can ask, why is it here? And if I want to give a full account of the rat's existence, I'll have to appeal to other contingent things. I'll have to start talking about that romantic night in when mummy and daddy rat started getting it on and so on. The world seems to be full of objects like this. Things that don't have to exist. That might not have existed, but they do exist. So the question is, are contingent things the only things that exist? Does every existing reality have this property of contingency? And Thomas thinks not. Now, the reasoning he gives isn't entirely clear, and readers of Thomas still aren't sure exactly what he meant, but the following will do for our purposes. If all that exists is contingent, then everything, the totality of existing things, is one massive question mark. And not a mysterious question mark, an agnostic question mark, but a definitive question mark. A question mark trying to do the job of a full stop, or of a period for our American friends. Because the rat is contingent, I can ask, why does the rat exist? If all that exists is contingent, I'm still invited to ask the question, why does anything exist? Why is there something rather than nothing? But now, if there's no non-contingent being left to appeal to, then I'm guaranteed that there's no answer to that question. Why is there something rather than nothing? Now, some people are happy to leave it at that and to say either that the question stands eternally or that the question makes no sense, it's not a good question, and it ought not to be asked. But Aquinas thinks that this question, why does anything exist, is as good a question as any. And there's no a priori reason to think that it shouldn't be asked or that it doesn't have an answer. There's no a priori reason to think that the existence of the physical world could not be accounted for in principle. And if this question does have an answer, even a mysterious answer, then that means there must be something outside the pile of contingency. There must exist a necessary being, a being which cannot not exist, an anchor or a root on which all contingent things depend. One of these beings is not like the others. And this being we call God. Now note that Thomas, and this is the same for all of the five ways, he doesn't start with the definition of God and then say that this God must be necessary, a necessary being, as if he's making an uncalled for exception for God. He starts with the way the world is and says that in order for the world to be as it is, there must be some X which has this feature, necessity, this feature that it cannot not exist, and that X sounds a lot like what we usually call God. So that's Thomas's third way. As I said, I'm not going to go into great detail defending this argument or the other arguments for the existence of God. Instead, I'm going to use these arguments to properly understand classical theism. There are certain properties of God and of the world which are implicit in these arguments or consequences of these arguments or congruent with these arguments. And when we put all of these properties together, they yield a particular worldview. So, what properties of God are we talking about? God is a cause, that's the second way. God is necessary, that's the third way. God produces order, it's the fifth way. We can say too that the God of classical theism is transcendent. He is outside, in a certain sense, the chain of causes which he grounds. He's outside the world of contingent beings whose foundation he is. So he's not, and this is very important, the God of classical theism is not an object within the universe. He's not a being like us, but just more powerful. He's not an old man in the sky. He's not a being at all, according to Thomas's theistic perspective. He's the reason for the existence of every being. He's the ground of all being. What about the properties of the world? The world is caused. That's the second way. It's a complex world with all kinds of complex processes going on, but all of this multiplicity can be traced back to one transcendent cause. The world is ordered. That's the fifth way. It's law-abiding. And because it's law-abiding, it's intelligible. We can understand the world. And it's somehow predictable. And all of this order speaks of an underlying intelligence. And finally, the world is contingent. It's a world about which we can ask why. Just as an aside, when I was about 15, I came across a quotation from St. Catherine of Siena. Here she is. A revelation in which she had heard the Lord say to her, "I am he who is, you are she who is not." And the teenage me was really intrigued by this little dictum. I am he who is, you are she who is not. In other words, I am a necessary being, you are a contingent being. Now, I didn't know at the time what the words necessary and contingent meant, but I remember really getting this. I don't have to exist. And that insight absolutely blew my mind, but it also gave me this profound joy. I became a little mystic for a short time. I was amazed at every tree and every flower. I was saying to myself, this tree doesn't have to exist. This flower doesn't have to be here, but it is. The world could be otherwise. The whole world doesn't have to be here, but it is. Now, that sense of amazement lasted for about 3 days until the next wave of hormones knocked me back to my usual state of unamazement, but that insight stayed with me. So let's get back again to the theist worldview. There are other properties of God typically attributed to God in classical theism: goodness, wisdom, and so on. And when we add them into the mix, that picture, that worldview, fills out nicely. So God isn't just the neutral ground of being. He's a good creator who determines to produce a variety of creatures, each made for their own flourishing. So moss is given moss nature and flourishes in a mossy way. Humans are made differently. They're given a different nature, one that includes intellect and will, and therefore freedom. Unlike moss, we are made to flourish in freedom, or not to flourish, to flounder, as the case may be. Now, Thomas describes the way he sees this operating in creation using a really nice analogy. He says shipbuilders use wood to make ships. The shipbuilder has a purpose, and he applies this purpose to inanimate wood. But Thomas says, imagine shipbuilders could make the wood also have a purpose, so that it assembles itself into a ship. It always makes me think of the self-stirring cauldron in Harry Potter. That's the kind of maker God is. The world he created is populated with little contingent beings like ourselves who are not the causes of our own existence, but who can nevertheless freely move ourselves and choose between alternatives and act consciously with an end in mind. So Tolkien had this nice scheme where he said there's the creator and there's creatures, but some of these creatures are given the dignity of being sub-creators. That's his term. And that's us. Now, we said earlier that the theist world is an ordered world of causes, but it's not just a closed system of causes, like a load of snooker balls bouncing around the snooker table in a predetermined way, because some of these snooker balls, us, have their own little unpredictable motors. So Thomas's worldview accounts for two very important features: freedom on the one hand and order on the other. Now, this is very important for what I'm going to say later, so I want to present an analogy just to clarify what I mean. Think of the relationship between the sun and our lives. Whether we like it or not, we're all flying around the sun at this very minute at about 100,000 kilometres an hour. The gravitational pull of the sun, it's just the inescapable framework in which we all live. We're completely dependent on the sun for energy. That's where the food we eat gets its energy, ultimately, from the sun. And the fuel we burn for our electricity, that comes from the sun, ultimately. So we're utterly dependent on the sun in every area of our daily lives, and our lives are organized and ordered around this fact. But we would never think of the sun as limiting our freedom. We'd never shake our fist at the sun and say, "Get out of my life, you're not the boss of me." So our lives are organized around the sun, but the sun also makes our lives possible. And that's what I mean when I speak of the God of classical theism accounting for both order and freedom. Now, this theistic worldview sounds very nice and everything, but what's the biggest problem with it? Evil, right? If all I've said is true, what about evil? The world is contingent. It could be otherwise. So we can reasonably ask why things are so messed up. We say that a good God is the cause of all that exists, and that this good God inscribes everything with an inner law for its own flourishing, So why aren't things flourishing as they should? We say that the world is ordered, that there's a way things ought to be, so where do things go wrong? Why do we suffer? Why do tsunamis happen? Why do some children die before their parents? There are lots of different responses to these questions, and personally, I've never been entirely satisfied by any of the standard solutions taken on their own. And the problem of evil isn't something I consider solved and that I can set to one side. Speaking as a priest, this problem is something I inhabit all the time, and it's not a theoretical problem for any of us, whether we're atheists or theists. It's a problem we all have to live. So I'm not going to propose any easy solutions, but I will say this. It's worth pondering the fact that evil becomes a real problem within the worldview of classical theism. The reason we can identify suffering as evil and not just as unpleasant is because we have a strong theory of goodness. We see evil as a departure from the way things ought to be, but we can only do that because we have a strong theory of the way things ought to be. So I'm going to suggest later that atheism and various forms of atheism, that they don't solve the problem of evil any more than theism, and that certain forms of atheism simply dissolve the problem, but we'll get onto that. So a final element of the theistic worldview, it provides a rational basis for both morality and political life. And it does so because it accounts for both order and freedom. The largest part of St. Thomas's Summa, these two books here, the second part, is devoted to questions of morality. He talks there about how humans deliberate, how they act, what role emotions play in our decision-making, about our habits, about law, about the natural law, about grace, about the virtues, and all that kind of stuff. And at every stage of that conversation, he's assuming that there is such a thing as human nature, that humans, for all their diversity, have something in common, that they're constituted in a certain way, that we're all made for happiness without exception, that we're all built to be properly motivated by love and fear and hate, and that we're habit-forming animals. There's something given here. There's an order, a recipe to be followed for the flourishing of the human person. And that recipe is what we mean when we speak of the natural law, I'm sure a phrase you've heard before. In other words, there's an ought written into the is. There's an imperative within the indicative. There's an ought written into the is. But we're not like Moss. For Moss, there's no gap between the ought and the is. But for us, there is. Why? Because we have this thing called free will. Morality isn't a category that applies to Moss, but it does apply to us because we have free will. We're self-movers. We're principles of our actions. And what we do might or might not correspond to what we ought to do. So on the one hand, we have order, and on the other, we have freedom. And it's only when we have those two together that we can start talking about morality. When we see something horrific, like, you know, people putting needles in strawberries, like you've seen in Australia recently, when we see something like that, and we react and we say, that's so wrong, we're implying, by saying that, that there is a right way for things to be, and that this, whatever it is, doesn't correspond to that standard. When we say to someone, you shouldn't have done that, or well done for doing that, we're implying that they could have done otherwise. In the first case, we're assuming a moral order. In the second, we're assuming the reality of freedom. And a theistic account, as I've outlined, accounts for both of these essential aspects of our everyday moral language. Now, I'm not for a second suggesting that this makes theists good or makes them any better than atheists. That's not what I'm saying at all. It's an entirely different question. I'm just saying that our moral claims, the moral claims that we make all the time, make sense if we conceive of a transcendent creator who provides for order and freedom. And note here as well that I'm not saying that we need a transcendent creator to come in out of nowhere and give us arbitrary commands about what we ought to do. I think a lot of atheists presume that this is where God intersects with morality in a theistic scheme. But in Thomas's vision, God comes in much earlier in the story. Now, a similar point can be made about political life. If we live in an unjust state, what are our grounds for rebellion? What is it that enables us to say, this has to end? Things ought to be different, so let's start a revolution. If statements like that are going to have any meaning at all, we're going to have to make reference again to those two fixed points, order and freedom. There is a way things ought to be, and we are really free. I said earlier that Thomas held that our human nature is the basis for moral action, and the same is true in politics. We're political animals, he said. That's just Aristotle. And we're made to flourish together. We have an inbuilt compass within us that points us not only to my individual good, but also to the common good. And I've given you two quotations on the handout, texts 5 and 6 from Thomas, which show this really, really nicely. Definitely wants to read later. Now, Thomas is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a political radical. He thinks that we should be really slow to remove political leaders, but he does think it can be just to do so. Because, again, there is a way things ought to be, and we have the freedom to act so as to restore that right order. Now, this idea has real power. I've given you an excerpt, text 7, from a well-known document, the letter from Martin Luther King, when he was in Birmingham jail in 1963. He wrote this to his fellow clergymen, and he encouraged them to support civil disobedience, to support disobeying the law. Now, I'm not going to read through the text now, but this whole argument is based on the theistic worldview that I've been outlining. And he even name-drops St. Thomas Aquinas and his theory of natural law. Now, a theory of natural law doesn't mean that it's obvious to us what we should do as individuals or as communities. That's not what I'm claiming. And it might, in fact, be really difficult to figure out what we ought to do. But it means that we can have a rationally grounded discussion about what we should do, and that we can make claims about what we should do based on something more than just power games. So Martin Luther King, he isn't saying just hooray for racial integration and boo to racial segregation. He's saying that one corresponds to the way things ought to be and the other doesn't. Now, finally, moving on to atheism. As I said, I'm not here to tell anyone how to be an atheist. You're all grown-ups. But I can't help feeling that many of us and many of our contemporaries are practical atheists. We live as if atheism were true, but maybe without having thought through all the implications of atheist positions. So I want to examine here how two great atheist thinkers have avoided the conclusions that Thomas makes in his five ways, and then to sketch the worldviews that result from their starting points. And I think those worldviews are highly problematic. So both of these approaches involve refusing to answer the question that I mentioned earlier in connection with the third way: why is there something rather than nothing? Speaking personally, when I was about your age, for some of you, I went through a period where I really wanted to be an atheist. I obviously didn't do a very good job, but I really wanted to. And it was precisely this question: why is there something rather than nothing? That was the question I couldn't shake. I remember sitting by the river, the calm, and just looking up at the clouds and saying, why do you exist? That question, why is there something rather than nothing? I just couldn't shake it. I couldn't turn away from it. Now, so we know how Thomas answers the question, why is there something rather than nothing? He says the whole world is contingent, the physical world is contingent, it's one massive question mark, and the question is resolved by appeal to a being who necessarily exists, a full stop, if you like, but a very mysterious full stop, because we don't know its nature. That's important. Now, one atheist strategy will be to say that the world is full of contingent things, little question marks, fine, but it itself, the whole world, the totality, is not contingent. In other words, it just is. So this approach just rubs out that big question mark and replaces it with a full stop. So they take the category of necessity that I had applied to God, and they apply this category to the world, the physical world. And because they apply this category of necessity to the world, I'm going to call it N-atheism for our purposes. N for necessity. Another strategy is to say that the world is contingent, but that that's all there is. All that exists is contingent, and there's no necessary being to ground all that contingency. So this approach just keeps that question mark in place, and the question mark is final. I've called this style of atheism C-atheism, C for contingency. So, just going to talk a bit about N-atheism. I'm sure if you're familiar with debates about the existence of God, you've probably heard of the radio debate in 1948, I think, between F.C. Copleston, a Jesuit and a brilliant historian of philosophy, and Bertrand Russell, a great logician and campaigner against nuclear war and so many other things. So, here he is. Great man for the pipe. So, in this debate, Russell states with great clarity the position that I've called N-atheism. I've given you the text of the relevant bit of that debate on the handout. I think it's text 8. And Russell says at a certain point that the universe is just there, and that's all. Full stop, end of story. It's just there. Now, there are problems with that position. Copleston pointed out that making the universe the cause of itself, making the universe a necessary being, doesn't seem to work, because the universe as a whole seems to be the type of being that we wouldn't call a necessary being, above all because it had a beginning, if the Big Bang Theory is true. The universe seems to be just as much of a big, flashing neon question mark as anything within the universe. But Russell wants to assert that the universe just is. Its existence is a brute fact. So it's one problem with the position, but there are other ones. N-atheists are also typically materialists and determinists. In other words, they hold that all that exists is material and entirely subject to the laws of physics. And because this is the case, our freedom, our apparent freedom, is an illusion. We may seem to have freedom, but that's just because the causal chain that we're a part of is actually really, really complex. But ultimately, according to N-atheism, our actions are as predictable as snooker balls in a snooker table, or the trajectory of a stone. Now, you can see why materialism and determinism fit with N-atheism. If the world is just there, a brute fact, then it's hard to see how anything could arise within the world that wouldn't be similarly just there, necessary, a brute fact. So I've said that theism in the style of Thomas Aquinas allows for both order and freedom, but N-atheism is all order and no freedom. And that means that all our moral talk is groundless. We can't blame somebody for what they've done any more than we can blame a broken toaster. We can't describe something as right or as wrong, because that would imply that things could have been otherwise. And this really should disturb atheists in this tradition of N-atheism, but it doesn't necessarily seem to much. You'll easily find videos on YouTube of Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss and Ricky Gervais calmly admitting that they think free will is an illusion, but that it doesn't really matter, as we act as if we were really free. We act as if we were really free, and that's enough. It doesn't really matter that we're all living a massive lie. I think it does. The same is true of political discourse. If N-atheism is true, there's no right political order and wrong political order. There's just what happens. Now, I'm not saying that atheists of this type are any less moral or any less politically engaged than theists. That's not the claim I'm making at all. Russell himself was very politically engaged. And many of my atheist friends are exceptionally upright and engaged and so on. And they tell me their atheism plays a positive role in their moral development. And maybe it does. But the basic idea of N-atheism undermines all of our moral and political discourse. And that seems to me a pretty big problem. N-atheism also solves the problem of evil, or it dissolves it. There's no such thing as evil, because there's no such thing as good. There just is what there is. For the theist, the suffering of a child is a really, really big problem, and a problem that doesn't go away easily. But the N-atheist actually has no grounds on which to identify the suffering of a child as evil. It's simply something that happens. Now again, I'm not suggesting for a minute that actual atheists will lack empathy for those who are suffering. Far from it. But I'm saying that the logical conclusion of this type of atheism is to say that a child that is sick and a child that is well are both simply things that happen. They're brute facts. I might have particular feelings towards each situation, and those feelings may move me to act and do something about the suffering, but my feelings and actions are the very same. They're just things that necessarily happen. And just in case you think I'm putting words into the mouths of N-atheists, here's a little quotation from Richard Dawkins which says exactly what I think atheists in this tradition are logically constrained to say. It's text 9 on your handout. In a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. So that's N-atheism. An entirely different approach is taken by another great atheist thinker, Jean-Paul Sartre, another great man for the pipe. He also refuses to answer the question, why is there something rather than nothing? Now, he won't countenance a necessary being. So he simply says that everything that exists is contingent. He was obsessed with the theme of contingency. I just found out recently that when he was an undergraduate student in the École Normale Supérieure, he wrote a hymn to contingency, Le Chant de la Contingence. But his best-known writing on this theme, it comes in one of his novels, Nausea, La Nausée. So as I read this passage, just bear in mind what I had said earlier about the kind of mystical experience that many theists feel when they feel the contingency of the world and the dependence of everything on God. There's something similar going on here, but Sartre brings it one step further, and the consequent feeling isn't one of joy. So just to fill you in, the main character in the story, he kind of stands for Sartre, and he's had an experience sitting under a chestnut tree, an experience of the contingency of all things, and this is how he describes it in his diary. The essential thing is contingency. I mean that one cannot define existence as necessity. To exist is simply to be there. Those who exist let themselves be encountered, but you can never deduce anything from them. I believe there are people who have understood this, only they try to overcome this contingency by inventing a necessary being, the cause of itself, cause de soi. And you can hear in the background there, causa sui, the Latin term that Thomas Aquinas would have used. And Sartre here very much has Thomas Aquinas in his targets. But no necessary being can explain existence, he says. Contingency is not a delusion, a probability which can be dissipated. It is the absolute, l'absolu. It's the absolute. Contingency is the final thing. And consequently, perfect gratuity. All is gratuitous, this park, this city, and myself. When you realise that, it turns your stomach and everything begins to float. Here is nausea. Here there is what those blackguards, the ones on the Côte au Vert and others, they're the bourgeois. Here's what they try to hide from themselves with their idea of their rights. But what a poor lie. No one has any rights. They, these people, are entirely gratuitous like other men. They cannot succeed in not feeling superfluous. And in themselves, secretly, they are superfluous. That is to say, amorphous, vague, and sad. So, for Sartre, everything is contingent. And everything is rootless and floating. And each one of us is one of those rootless, floating things. Without reason for being, direct quotation, without any relation to another being. Gratuitous for all eternity. That's the content of C-atheism. And if N-atheism is all order and no freedom, then C-atheism is all freedom and no order. I am contingent, superfluous, and utterly free to define myself, to make my own project. And that project isn't something that's necessarily programmed into human nature that's given to me, because Sartre was very keen on the idea that human nature doesn't exist. Existence precedes essence, he said. And what I meant is that we're not first human beings with human nature who have freedom as part of our human nature, because that would imply a God who gives us human nature. He says first, freedom, pure freedom, and then we make ourselves human by our projects. Now the consequences of this worldview are just as immensely problematic as those of N-atheism. So once again, the problem of evil is dissolved, not by necessity this time, but by the absurdity of the world. And once again, all our everyday moral and political discourse is undermined. So, C-atheists, they might be exceptionally moral and politically engaged, but ultimately, they have to admit that they're simply trying to produce a little colony of meaning in an absurd universe. And if they really believe that each one of us is merely the author, the utterly free author of our own story, it's hard to see how they could judge any particular actions as right or wrong. Whether we're serial killers or pediatricians, we're all just carrying out our different projects. There's a great Portlandia sketch based on this phrase, you do you. It's worth looking up on YouTube afterwards. You can find, it's this very problem, that we're all just doing our own projects. That's slightly problematic. Sartre quotes a line from Dostoevsky, if God did not exist, everything would be permitted. And Sartre says, that's the starting point of existentialism, his philosophy. And if our individual projects aren't based on a common shared human nature, then it's hard to see where the common good and political life can make an appearance. So Sartre says this explicitly. If there were a God, humanity could be a we. But there isn't a God, and so we're not a we. There's no common project. Think of what Estragon says to Vladimir in Waiting for Godot. He says, I sometimes wonder if we wouldn't have been better off alone, each one for himself. We weren't made for the same road. We weren't made for the same road. That sums up the problem that C-atheism poses to politics. Now, Sartre, he wants to save morality in politics, and so he imports these little Kantian ideas like nothing can be good for me unless it's good for all, but they seem like fairly arbitrary additions to his scheme. I don't know if any of you have read The Road by Cormac McCarthy or seen the movie. The two main characters are a man and his son, and the whole novel is about their wanderings in this terrifying, post-apocalyptic, unwelcoming wilderness. The father, he keeps giving the son the impression that they're going somewhere, but the father knows there's nowhere to go. And it's a really difficult novel to read, but it seems to me to sum up the worldview of sea atheism. Thomas Aquinas, when he talks about humans, he calls us viatores, people on a journey. But sea atheism can't really pay us the same compliment, because without a destination, we're only wanderers. Again, think of the end of Waiting for Godot. Well, shall we go? Yes, let's go. And then the terrifying stage direction, they do not move. They have nowhere to go. Sea atheism is all road and no destination. And N-atheism is all destination and no road. And both are kinds of paralysis. And if the sea atheist is consistent, then there are two feelings that are ruled out. The joy of being at home in the world, of belonging in the world, and the joy of having a destination. Now again, I don't want to be putting words into the mouths of atheists. So here's a passage from a French writer, Eric Emmanuel Schmitt, who had been a convinced atheist in the style of sea atheism. He was also in the École Normale Supérieure, where Sartre had been. But he suddenly came to faith one night during a voyage in the desert. He parted from his group, and he thought he was going to die. He describes then a few days later, now that God is a part of his mental universe, how differently things feel. Previously, he said, he had believed that the human person is alone in the universe, a little guardian of meaning in an absurd world. And the anguish that resulted from that worldview, he said it made him feel totally alone, like he was the only thinking being in the middle of an unthinking universe. But now, after this night in the desert, he feels something that he realizes he had never felt before, and he calls it joy. I'll quote him here. Unlike anguish, joy integrated me into the world and set me face to face with God. Thanks to this joy, I no longer felt isolated and a stranger. I felt fertile and united. The force which held all things was streaming through me too. Whereas anguish had made me too big, joy had reduced me to my proper proportions. Not great by myself, but great by the grandeur which had placed itself in me. The infinite was now the foundation of my finite spirit, like a bowl which contained my soul. And just by coincidence or by providence, I'd asked months ago a nun in Drogheda, she's from Belarus, to pray for me when I was preparing this talk. And she sent me an email this morning, nuns forgetting nothing. She sent me an email this morning, and I never knew that this nun had been an atheist. And she just described very, very briefly her experience. And she summed it up in two words. She said, pure joy. That was the feeling. And she said she hopes people come to know that same joy. And that very much chimes with Schmitt's testimony here. So I've shown two great atheist strategies which seek to avoid answering the question, why is there something rather than nothing? The question which is at the heart of the theistic worldview. And I've tried to show the huge problems inherent in both of these strategies. And I do so with great respect for those who hold them. I have an illustrious predecessor in this task, the famous atheist Friedrich Nietzsche. He was annoyed by the atheists of his own day, who he thought didn't fully appreciate the significance of their atheism. They didn't realize the enormity of the revolution in which they were partaking. And to make this point, Nietzsche created a little parable. I'm sure some of you have read it. So bear in mind, when I'm reading this, how I compared God in the theistic scheme as guarantor of freedom and order. I compared him to the sun in the natural order. So the parable that Nietzsche writes, it involves a madman speaking to a crowd of bourgeois atheists. He tells them that God is dead, and all the atheists laugh at him and make fun of him, and they're very, trite and so on. And then the madman really takes off. And this is what he says. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. Where is God? He cried. I'll tell you, we have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. And here's the important bit. But how did we do this? How could we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun? Where is it moving now? Where are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually? backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there still any up or down? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not night continually closing in on us? Do we not need to light lanterns in the morning? Like Nietzsche, I'm convinced that atheism is far more revolutionary than most of us realize. I'm also convinced it's not true. And I'm convinced that many self-designated atheists haven't followed through the logical consequences of their ideas right to the end. And I think it's really worth doing so. And that's why I'm glad to be here, not to spread hopelessness and despair. But my hope is that those who feel the loss of God might come to feel the warmth of the sun on his face and to realise that the night apparently closing in on us that Nietzsche thought of was, in fact, only an eclipse. My hope is that my atheist friends might come out on the far side of atheism with a stronger sense of what it means to say God, and with hearts and minds made purer by the very experience of their atheism. And I'm going to end just by reading out a little passage which nobody can disagree with because there's no arguments in it, it's purely descriptive. It's from the diary of Virginia Woolf. Then for a moment we saw the sun sweeping. We saw it crescent burning red. Next moment it had sailed fast into the cloud again. Only the red streamers came from it. Then only a golden haze, such as one has often seen. The moments were passing. I thought how we were like very old people in the birth of the world, druids on Stonehenge. At the back of us were great blue spaces in the cloud. These were still blue, but now the colour was going out. The 24 seconds were passing. Then one looked back again at the blue, and rapidly, very, very quickly, all the colours faded. It became darker and darker, as at the beginning of a violent storm. The light sank and sank. We kept saying, "This is the shadow." And we thought, "Now it is over. This is the shadow." When suddenly, the light went out. We had fallen. It was extinct. There was no colour. The earth was dead. That was the astonishing moment. And the next, when, as if a ball had rebounded, the cloud took colour in itself again, only a sparky, ethereal colour, and so the light came back. I had very strongly the feeling, as the light went out, of some vast obeisance. Something kneeling down and suddenly raised up when the colours came. The colour for some moments was of the most lovely kind, fresh, various, here blue and there brown, all new colours as if washed over and repainted. They came back astonishingly lightly and quickly and beautifully in the valley and over the hills, at first with a miraculous glittering and ethereality, later normally almost, but with a great sense of relief. It was like recovery. We had been much worse than we had expected. We had seen the world dead. This was within the power of nature. Our greatness had been apparent too. Thank you.